I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. If you're thinking about it, chances are we're talking about it on WHYY's Radio Times.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice.
In November 1966, a rookie police officer named Walter Barkley responded to a burglary in the Philadelphia neighborhood. There he encountered William Barnes, a 30-year-old with a long criminal record, who shot him. Barkley was paralyzed from the waist down and had to endure decades of medical problems, including infections, pneumonia, and bed sores. He died in August at a Bucks County hospital where the coroner ruled his death a homicide, a result of that shooting 41 years ago. Philadelphia District Attorney Lane Abraham has charged William Barnes with murder. She said her office would prove that the shooting in November 1966 led to Barkley's death last month. A perpetrator of a crime, she said, is responsible for every single thing that flows from that chain of events, no matter how distant, as long as we can prove the chain is unbroken. Now, some say this could be a tough case to prove in court. Barnes served 15 years for that shooting and spent most of his adult life in prison for a number of serious crimes and violations. He says it was the most shameful act in his life, but now, with these new charges against him, he says he feels like a victim. This case, this story has generated a fair amount of attention and opinions, and that's our topic for today's Radio Times. We've got two lawyers who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studios. George Newman is a criminal defense attorney in practice here in Philadelphia. Nice to have you back with us. Good morning, George.
It's my pleasure, Marty. Glad to be here.
Nice to have you here. And Sadie Ladov is a partner in Abrahams, Lowenstein & Bushman. She's vice chancellor of the Philadelphia Bar Association and a former Bronx prosecutor. And Sadie, nice to have you back with us as well. Good morning.
Good morning. Great to be here, Marty.
Nice to have you here. And Sadie, let me begin with you. Is this an unusual case?
Yes, it is an unusual case, but one thing one premise that we have to accept is that Barnes is being indicted for murder. The time that he served, what he was convicted of in what I'll call the first go-round, was attempted murder. These are two separate crimes. And there is no such thing, and I know George and I are going to talk about this as the morning progresses, but there is no such concept in the law as moral double jeopardy.
Meaning
that if the defendant in this particular case was indicted and convicted and served time for a particular crime, he could not be indicted, convicted, and serve time for the same crime. And while attempted murder and murder, mm-hmm. obviously to the layperson, may seem like a similar offense, it is not the same offense, because obviously the critical difference is a person survives attempted murder, a person is dead when it comes to murder.
Well, let me turn to you, George. Then we've got one shooting but two crimes separated by 41 years.
Well, you know, Sadie's correct that the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania has the power to prosecute Mr. Barnes. But the real issue isn't whether the Commonwealth has the power to do it. The real question is, should the Commonwealth mm-hmm. do it? Is it right to do it? Is it fair to do it? And I think that's where people differ. You know, I looked at a number of letters to the editor. You can access them online. And the informal poll I did seemed to be that sentiment was running two to one. Against Mr. Barnes being prosecuted for this. A lot of people just felt, you know, he served a lot of time in prison. Mm-hmm. He's expressed remorse. He's an old man. He's 71 years old. He walks with a cane. He's had two heart attacks. This happened 41 years ago. Enough is enough. It's time to stop.
Well, and I ran across some of what the coroner in Bucks County said, and he talked about the suffering of Officer Barkley, that as a result of the shooting, he, of course, was paralyzed from the waist down. He had a catheter, and a catheter leads to infections and pneumonia and bed sores. He died of a heart attack, but the coroner thinking that heart attack was related to the infection. So we've also got a victim here who suffered enormously over a course of 41 years.
And that's usually what is the subject of lawsuits. But we're not talking about a lawsuit here. We're not talking about pain and suffering, because, again, Mr. Barnes did a lot of time for this case, and it may have been actually 20 years. The record's unclear about how much time he did. But the issue here isn't whether the officer, the former officer, had a depreciated life and lived in pain. The issue is, should Mr. Barnes be prosecuted 41 years later for this man who died of a heart attack? And it's going to be, the legal issue is actually pretty clear. It's going to be, was there direct causation? Although there's a really separate thing that's going to be going on here. It's not just the legal issue of the causation, because a jury is ultimately going to be asked to do the right thing. And a jury may look at this and they may say, no, there wasn't a right, I'm not convinced beyond a reasonable doubt there was direct causation. So they'll find him not guilty.
Right.
On a parallel track, a jury may look at this and say, 41 years later and the guy did all this time and enough is enough. And they may agree with the writers of all those letters who say, we're not going to convict him.
And I guess for the prosecutor's side, Sadie, is that they have to prove this causation, that what happened 41 years ago was the reason that this police officer died.
Exactly. And it really is going to be a fascinating case to try, and really it's going to be a legal lesson to observe, because Lynn Abraham is absolutely correct. There must be an unbroken chain. A defendant, whether it is in a civil action or in a criminal action, is responsible for all the acts that flow. In a civil action, we would call that consequential damages. It's not that different in a criminal action, except that the standard of proof is much higher. It's beyond a reasonable doubt. So this is a case that's really going to hinge on competent medical evidence, and it will turn out to be a battle of the medical experts.
And is that, I mean, we know how the legal system works. One side hires one legal expert, another side hires the other legal expert, and then they go at it in a courtroom.
That's right. And the function of the jury will be to assess the credibility of the experts and determine whose version of the facts, whose version of the medical testimony makes better sense to them beyond a reasonable doubt. But George is absolutely right. It would be disingenuous to say that with the kind of media attention that this case is and will generate, getting an impartial jury pool is going to be very difficult. When our jury pool is inundated with letters to the editor,
radio shows,
television shows, it's going to be hard when a potential juror is questioned, for that juror to say, I have no opinion. Someone is going to have an opinion.
Right.
Unless they're, of course, living under a rock.
Right. But that's always the problem, I guess, with juries and cases that get a fair amount of publicity.
Absolutely.
But I wonder to you, George, and maybe this is more the kind of cynicism that people have about the legal system, is that you hire your experts, in this case medical experts, and then they go at it, and it's up to a jury to decide who they're going to believe. But you can get an expert who can say something directly opposite from what the other expert
absolutely
says.
And there are several interesting things already on the radar screen in terms of the experts. Number one, there was no autopsy in this case, and that's going to hurt the prosecution a lot. The defense is going to be hammering away at the fact that whether it was the family's choice or the Commonwealth's choice or whoever made the choice, that we really never will know exactly why this man died, because there was no autopsy. It's just records. It's just cold records. And I think that
and
puts
the coroner's report, obviously.
And the coroner's report, which is based simply on the records, which is based on the cold record of what doctors jotted down in the hospital as things occurred. So that's going to be one issue, unless, of course, there's independent interviews of the various doctors who are involved, which is going to create a whole set of side issues.
Sure.
There's another factor here. I suspect, I don't know for a fact, that Mr. Barnes is going to have court-appointed counsel in Philadelphia. And I've been intimately involved in the court-appointed system for many years, and I say this in no way to denigrate court-appointed lawyers, but that lawyer, even though they have the initial advantage of no autopsy, is going to have the disadvantage of being a court-appointed lawyer, because this city has traditionally refused to appropriate reasonable funds, not only for the lawyers, but particularly for the experts.
And if mount a case for your
and
client.
Exactly. And if I were the court-appointed lawyer in this case, I would be demanding the best pathologists in the world. Hmm. I would want Henry Lee and everybody else who's there. And frankly, I think in this case they're entitled to it.
Well, and the I agree. The defendant absolutely deserves the best defense. Not a defense, but the best defense. And it is an ongoing struggle, probably worthy of a show unto itself, as to the amount of money that is appropriated by the First Judicial District for representation of indigent defendants. But it will become a battle of the experts. And what happens is that jurors assess, as I said before, they assess credibility. They'll look at Marty as the expert for one side and George as the expert for the other, and they'll determine, you know, I like her qualifications better than his. What he says makes more sense. What she says, you know, maybe she's a shill. But this goes on in courtrooms each and every day, and Indeed. It is incumbent on both of the lawyers, the prosecution and the defense attorney, to say to the jurors, use your common sense. Don't leave it at the courtroom door. You didn't get to where you are in your life today by living in a vacuum. Figure out what is more likely than not, and in this particular case, does it rise to the level of beyond a reasonable doubt?
And this is getting back to this idea of this unbroken chain. It seems to me, I mean, the longer time goes on, the more difficult it is to prove this unbroken chain. And now we're talking about 41 years. So what happened 41 years ago, you know, a horrible crime, and a young man ended up in a wheelchair for the rest of his life and with all the attendant medical problems with that. But can you really prove that shooting was the cause of this death when people have a certain lifestyle? They make choices about how they're going to live, and that can affect their health as well.
Well, I absolutely agree with you, but, you know, Mr. Barkley in a wheelchair didn't really have, unless he was engaging in risky behavior while in the wheelchair, but I'm going to make the assumption that he was not. I'm going to make the assumption that he was in a wheelchair, he was limited as to his activities, that he had appropriate medical care during that 41-year gap, that he did everything he could to prolong the quality of his life. But unfortunately, as a paraplegic, mm-hmm. he had a set of circumstances imposed upon him that he was stuck with and could not better. The infections, the catheters, the decubitus ulcers. You know, look, we all healthy males have a life expectancy today of something in the mid to late 70s, perhaps even early 80s. This is a man who died well below mm-hmm. his life expectancy.
71.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what, we're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation with our guest. That's Sadie LaDove. She's a partner in the law firm of Abrahams, Lowenstein & Bushman here in Philadelphia. She's also vice chancellor of the Philadelphia Bar Association. Also with us is George Newman. He's a criminal defense attorney. He's been in practice in Philadelphia for more than 3 decades. And we invited both of them to join us today on Radio Times to talk about a case that has gotten a fair amount of attention, about a crime that was committed some 41 years ago. And the person charged with that crime has now been charged with murder. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Winterthur Museum and Country Estate presents Quilts in a Material World. Selections from the Winterthur Collection. Open now through September 16th in the Winterthur Galleries. More than 40 quilts from the 17th to the 19th century are on view to the public, many for the first time ever. For more information, the number is 1-800-448-3883 or online at winterthur.org. Winterthur Museum and Country Estate proudly supports WHYY.
I'm Jesse Thorne, America's radio sweetheart. My show, The Sound of Young America, is a radio show about things that are awesome. Music, culture, comedy, whatever. Every week, I find a couple of the most interesting people in America and get them talking about what they do. Now you can listen in right here. That's The Sound of Young America from PRI, Public Radio International. Friday night at 9 on WHYY.
Do roses really love garlic? Do marigolds really protect nearby plants from pests? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll try to sort out garden neighbor fact from fiction with a close look at companion planting. Plus, chemical-free answers to all your garden questions. That's You Bet Your Garden, Saturday morning at 11, right here on WHYY 91 FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. 41 years ago, a rookie police officer in Philadelphia named Walter Barkley was shot by William Barnes, a man with a long criminal record. Walter Barkley was paralyzed. Barnes served a number of years, 15 to 20 years in prison for the crime. Barkley died in August, and Barnes has been charged with his murder by Philadelphia District Attorney Lynn Abraham. This is 41 years after the crime was committed. This decision has generated some controversy in a variety of different reactions and opinions, and that's what we're talking about today on Radio Times with our guests, lawyers George Newman and Sadie LaDove. And if you've been following this case, what are your opinions about what's the fair thing to do? Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Before we get to our callers, George, and we were talking with Sadie before the break about how she sees this chain of events, about how a prosecutor then would determine that something that happened in 1966, 41 years ago, then led through this chain of events to the death, the sad death of this police officer. How do you see the chain of events, even as a defense attorney?
Well, you know, the defense is certainly going to attack what Sadie just, you know, the proposition that she just put forth. The questions are going to be, what lifestyle did the former officer live? What did he, was he a smoker or not? What was his diet like? Did he listen to his doctors? Was there a family history of heart attacks? I mean, there's a whole, so many different possible intervening factors which can break that direct chain. That's certainly going to be part of the case.
And that'll be part of the arguments that
absolutely
the jury will hear.
And then again, returning to what I said earlier, I think even though a jury is going to be looking at the legal issue of causation, the factual issue of causation, the big thing in their mind is going to be, what's fair? What's mm-hmm. the right thing to do? They're going to be, the defense lawyer is going to argue this is such an old case and it's unfair and the man's done 20 years and why are we doing this? And we have, you know, nearly 300 murders in Philadelphia that are going on, and a lot of them are not being solved, and we're spending time on mm-hmm. this. I mean, the arguments are pretty clear how it's going to. This is going to be an appeal ultimately to emotion more than reason.
And maybe even more than the law?
Yeah, absolutely.
Does that trouble you?
Of course it troubles me because, you know, by the same token, a prosecutor could say, yes, we have 300 murders that are unsolved, but here where we have the opportunity to bring closure, finally closure to a murder case, you, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, have the opportunity to give the victim his due, and to send a message to the doers of those the unapprehended doers of the 300 murders. We will find you. We will get you. You will have to suffer the consequences. And, you know, it reminds me in a certain way of some of the civil rights cases in the South where defendants were not brought to justice until so many years later, when the Medgar Evers case was right. retried, when the three little girls who died in the church bombing, yeah. Now, granted, these folks who were ultimately tried and convicted had not served time.
Exactly, right.
But the listeners still have to remember that this same victim, different crime.
Different crime, because we're talking about attempted murder versus murder.
Yes.
But I wonder, and this is back to you, Sadie LaDove, and I've only read about William Barnes. I know he's been interviewed, and he spent more than 50 years, I think, in prison. I mean, a long track record of criminal activities. But he says he's turned his life around. He apparently is doing some speaking for the Eastern State Penitentiary. And after a life of crime, he wants to, at least on paper, allegedly, wants to be a better person, and he saw this as a really shameful thing that he had done. Does that count for anything in this case?
It counts, I would suggest, in the sentencing phase of the case, should he be found guilty. When a court is going to look at and take the measure of the man, Fortunately or unfortunately, depending on your point of view, if you are convicted of murder in this Commonwealth at this time, Mr. Barnes is going to serve the rest of his natural life in prison, so that notwithstanding his efforts to turn his life around, it may be for naught.
Is this double jeopardy? Is the statute of limitations, George, and then we'll get to
our
callers.
It's not double jeopardy on the charging end of things. There's actually an interesting legal argument, which I won't spend a lot of time on double jeopardy on the sentencing end of it. And that is actually a good issue that, the charge, as I understand it, I mean, it's murder, but the most likely conviction, if he were to be convicted, would be of what was then, back in 1966, second-degree murder, which is now third-degree murder, for which the maximum sentence was 20 years.
And if he's already served 15
he's already
to 20
served
years.
20 years. He served. He was originally sentenced to 10 to 20. My understanding is he maxed out on. He did the 20. Mm-hmm. There is an argument that he's already done all of his time, and that this trial is for naught.
Hmm.
I mean we'd only find the answer to that question if he's convicted.
Right.
But I think that's also a powerful argument by the defense. Like, why are we here? Why are we doing this?
And do we use the laws of 1966 versus the laws that we have today?
So we use the laws of 1966.
Right.
And that's why I believe, not to put the cart before the horse, I think this is ultimately, if George is right, and I'm not 100% sure, but I don't think he's wrong, I could see this case evolving into a disposition of a plea bargain. Where he's sentenced to time served and it's out and it's done.
And does that mean it's a frivolous case or
No, it's
still
not
an important case.
It's still an important case. It's an important case for both the victim and for the defendant. It's important for the victim to truly bring closure to a horrible episode, to the family of the victim, who deserve justice. It is also a message to defendants that you will be, if found guilty, you will be responsible for the crime you committed and the consequences of the crime you committed. So I think both sides have to take a message from it.
And I saw from one of the family members, George, one of Barclay's, I believe, siblings, saw this as murder delayed. I mean, that was his analysis. Yes, the shot took place 41 years ago, but from the family's point of view, they see this as murder delayed.
Well, of course they would, and you know, that's the interesting thing. And Sadie several times mentioned the victims needing closure, the family of the victims needing closure. Well, we have an English-based system of law. We don't have, for example, in contrast, you have under Islamic law.
Under Sharia law,
you have the families have the right personally to take revenge. And we reject that idea. We don't feel that the family of any victim, you talk to the parents of someone who's raped, a girl who's raped, they're going to want to execute the guy, even though it's not a capital crime, right on the spot. We understand that. We appreciate those emotions, but we don't let them be the judges.
Hmm.
And we don't let the brother of the deceased officer be the judge here and drive the prosecution, decide what the strategy is and what's fair here. I think we have to keep focus on what really is overall, what's the fair thing to do here. And I appreciate the family's pain and I appreciate how they feel. I probably would, if I were in their shoes, feel exactly the same way. But they don't drive this.
Not entirely. You know, the only way that this deceased officer is going to have a voice and is going to be made a real person in front of the jury is by the testimony of the family members. And while I agree that they shouldn't drive the case, I think that to disregard the rights of the victim does not make our criminal justice system truly just for all the people who participate in it and who are part of it.
And I'll tell you what, let me just quickly reintroduce you, and I do want to get some callers in on the conversation. That's Sadie LaDove, partner in the law firm here in Philadelphia, Abrahams, Lowenstein, and Bushman, also vice chancellor of the Philadelphia Bar Association, and George Newman is a criminal defense attorney in practice in Philadelphia. And we invited both of them to join us today on Radio Time to give us their reactions, their assessment to a case that's gotten a fair amount of attention. It involves a shooting 41 years ago, a rookie police officer in Philadelphia, a man named Walter Barkley was shot by a 30-year-old man with a long criminal record whose name is William Barnes. Barkley was paralyzed. He died just a month ago. And I should say that William Barnes has been charged with his murder. And the question is this a fair case that someone is charged with a murder 41 years after a shooting? Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Bill from Belmont Hills to join us. Bill, go ahead. Your Radio Times.
Yeah, hi. Thanks. I'm not a lawyer, and I certainly don't like crime, but I think this question really undermines our whole system of justice. If Lynn Abraham says everything that follows from a crime the person is guilty of, where does it end? If an abusive parent raises a child, the child grows up and kills somebody, is the parent guilty of murder? If you have a gangbanger kill somebody who's already killed five people, is that gangbanger acquitted? Hmm. You know, who's going to keep tabs on all this? It's in the spirit of double jeopardy, if not under the law of double jeopardy, because the original crime in this case, the people in that jury who convicted this person of attempted murder knew the victim would eventually die, knew the victim would suffer, and the conviction carried those implications with it. So to charge this person again now that the person has died certainly is in the spirit of double jeopardy, and it's totally a politically motivated case.
Well, Bill, it's an interesting series of thoughts that you have there. Let me toss them first to Sadie LaDove, and I think it's interesting. He says, if we're talking about a chain of events, where do you draw the line?
You draw the line at a rational place. We try to be a rational society. That's what separates us from the lawlessness of other societies. And when I listen to Bill's arguments about the gangbanger and the abusive parent, sure, these folks are not directly responsible for the commission of the crime and the consequences that flow therefrom. But in this particular case, and only in this particular case, we have the shooter, Barnes, shooting Barkley. And I would submit that, sure, the jury may have known that ultimately Barkley would have died, but he might have, God forbid, died from cancer, having nothing to do with this episode. We have a medical examiner, we have a coroner, a physician, saying that this heart attack was causally related to the gunshot wound sustained 41 years ago. Either it's double jeopardy or it's not, and there's no such thing as the spirit of double jeopardy.
Go ahead, George.
I happen to disagree. I think that Bill put his finger right on what the really issue is, which is not, is this prosecution permissible under the law, which it is, and Lynn Abraham had a choice to make, and I believe she made the wrong choice, although I was not at all surprised by the choice. I expected the choice that she made. But it's, was she going to do the right thing? And I think when you've got a case like this where the death occurs 41 years later, she didn't do the right thing. And I've done a lot of murder cases. I've handled a lot of murder cases, capital cases, cop killing cases, more than one. And I've handled cases where the person who was shot died sometime later. And usually you're dealing with something like 9 months or something on that magnitude, and then there's no real legitimate question. But this isn't 9 months. This is 41 years, and I think for most people, they would look at that and say that's just enough. That's enough time has passed, and we're not going to do it. And it's different from what Sadie talked about earlier, where she talked about the civil rights prosecutions, because those people were never initially prosecuted, and the people were, there was no question of somebody dying 41 years later. They died right on the spot. Those three little girls were
blown up
right in the church. In fact, I know the prosecutor who prosecuted that case, Doug Jones, down in Alabama. He was an excellent U.S. attorney. And, the jury knew that was the right thing to do because the man who had done it had done an evil thing and had gotten away with it for all that period of time, and had never been brought to account, as in contrast to Mr. Barnes, who was brought to account.
Does this case in any way set legal precedent, or is it a bit of a legal sideshow, Sadie, and then we'll get back to our callers.
You know, that's a great question, and I must confess, I don't know the answer to that question. I don't know it, within Philadelphia, I don't know how many other cases have been brought by the prosecution where there has been a substantial passage of time. Yeah, I agree with George. If this was 6, 9 months, even a year, nobody would blink an eye. Everybody would say, right. Oh, absolutely. It's the 41 years that is making everyone sit up and take notice. And I really don't know statistically what the answer is.
Let me get back to our callers. We've got Joe from Westchester joining us. Hi, Joe. Go ahead. Your radio times.
Yeah. Hi, Marty. And, you know, my opinion is this, and I disagree with Sadie. I think this is a totally frivolous case. And one person who has a lot of respect for Lynn Abraham, I've lost a lot of respect because I think this is a case of grandstanding on her part to bring this case to trial or into the public venue as it is, because no matter what the outcome of this case is, I doubt whether Mr. Barnes will ever spend another day in jail or will ever be punished any further than he's already been punished. And not only is it a waste of time, but it's going to be a colossal waste of taxpayer money to bring this case to trial. And I, for one, and along with many of my friends whom I've discussed it with, wouldn't support any type of further conviction of Mr. Barnes. And I just think that Ms. Abraham was either coerced into bringing these charges or did it on her own for her own political agenda.
Okay.
And that's my opinion.
No, I appreciate you calling into Radio Times. Let me give you a chance to respond, Sadie.
Well, I don't speak for Lynn Abraham. I don't know what her political agenda is. I mean, this is what we do know in terms of the facts. This is not an election year for her. She has already, you know, it's well known that she is not going to run again for district attorney. So, you know, I can't speak for what her agenda is.
Do you have any opinion, George?
I mean, I know Lynn Abraham, and I don't think it's part of a political agenda because she's not running for anything. She's announced that this is her last term. On the other hand, it's very consistent with her philosophy, which is that it's completely victim-based. In other words, my view is that her office's policies are often driven by what I think is in an inappropriate consideration, the desires and intentions of victims and or their families. And I think that
you think
the
she
prosecutor
should be
yes, I think the prosecutor should say, I want to do the right thing in this circumstance, as opposed to folding up to the desires of the family. And I've seen a lot of decisions that have been made in the courtroom that are the family doesn't like it, I'm not going to do it, told to me by a prosecutor.
Okay.
I don't think that's appropriate.
Okay,
Sadie,
prosecutors should always, and I suggest that prosecutors, at least the way I was taught to prosecute a case many, many years ago, are duty-bound to determine whether or not bringing a case makes sense. Merely
legal sense, or just sense
exactly.
All the
for example,
sense of the word.
And I'm going to...
You know what? Hold on to that thought.
Okay.
Only because
hold on
to that thought. We're not in court. We're on the radio today, and I'm looking at the clock over your head. We have to take a very short break. Then we'll get back to our conversation with our guests and with you, Joe. Thank you for calling into Radio Times. We have just one open line at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Talking with Sadie LaDove and George Newman today on Radio Times about a very interesting legal case having to do with a murder and a shooting 41 years ago. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Alpine Lace Deli Swiss Cheese. Real Swiss cheese that's 25% reduced fat and sliced fresh at the local deli. Alpine Lace recipes and information are available online at alpinelace.com.
Next time on Day to Day.
I feel like crap right now, plain and simple.
Kevin Wright dreads the thought of having to capture and possibly euthanize another bear.
It's on the roof daily.
Residents near Aspen, Colorado complain the animals are invading their homes, so that's where Kevin comes in.
I have people rolling down their windows, yelling at me, but, you know, they need to channel their anger to the proper place.
America's growing battle with bears, next time on Day to Day.
this afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young from Public Radio's Daytime News Magazine, Here and Now. We bring you the news that happens between the morning headlines and the afternoon wrap-up, plus conversations with authors and music makers, stories that affect you, maybe a story about you. So please join us for Public Radio's daily digest of news and culture, Here and Now. Today at noon on WHYY.
The Philadelphia Inquirer is proud to support WHYY. The mega job section with thousands of job listings appears in The Inquirer Sunday, September 16th. The mega job section in The Inquirer Sunday, September 16th.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking about a crime that occurred 41 years ago. A police officer in Philadelphia, Walter Barkley, was shot by William Barnes. Barkley was paralyzed and he died last month. Barnes served some 15 to 20 years in prison for the crime, but now he's been charged with murder because of the death of Walter Barkley. And we're talking with Sadie LaDove and George Newman, both attorneys here in Philadelphia. Sadie, you wanted to say something before the break. Go ahead.
Yeah, all I was going to say, Marty and George, is in 1978, when I was a rookie assistant district attorney in Bronx County, New York, working for the late, great Mario Merola, Mr. Merola always would say that you must practice and you must prosecute with compassion. And he would give a very simple example. He would say, just think of two guys, same exact guy. One guy goes into the supermarket and steals and shoplifts a quart of milk to take it home and feed his starving child. Another guy goes into Bloomingdale's and steals a leather coat in order to go back out on the street and trade it for CDs. Do you prosecute? Mm. Do you prosecute the two guys, same case, same shoplift, okay? Do you decline to prosecute in a particular case, or do you prosecute them in the same way and make a different sentencing recommendation? A thoughtful prosecutor must think about the consequences of their own actions and the precedents that they set.
So this case, I mean, because it is so unusual, and I guess there are questions about any precedents, do you think it was, I mean, was it correct, do you think, to charge murder in this case,
though? I would sincerely hope that there was a decision made after a careful review of all the evidence available at the time that this case warranted the prosecution. I would hate to think that this was a knee-jerk reaction. Mm-hmm. I would hate to think that this was done as a grandstand. I would hopefully think that this was by the chief law enforcement officer who was following the law.
Very quickly, George, and then we'll get to our callers.
I would hope that was true, but frankly, I have no faith that that is true. I mean, really? I agree with Sadie, and those are the criteria upon which a prosecutor should decide whether or not to prosecute, but in this particular case, I think it was a knee-jerk reaction. I think it was preordained. There was absolutely no question when the news first came out the officer had died, and there was the supposed contemplation as to whether or not to prosecute. There was no question in my mind. It was 100% that there was going to be a prosecution. There was going to be no declination. Because that is the policy and pattern of this particular DA's office at this point in time.
Let me get to Nancy from Pennsauken to join us. Hi, Nancy. Go ahead. Your Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, I wanted to go back to a comment about lifestyle.
Sure.
And I am not one to blame a victim. However, I, as a person who is married to a man in a wheelchair who uses a catheter, and who leads has led an incredibly productive and useful life, and has been involved as a person who's worked, set up his own agency, involved in sports, and traveled throughout the world. I'm awestruck in some ways by the way that this man has been portrayed as a victim of this poor man who's a paraplegic. I don't understand where his rehab care was, or where his medical care was, or family support. Was this man shot and then allowed to languish? Mm. Is that why this happened? And therefore, I'm not sure. And that leads to the unbroken chain of events, but why wasn't the chain of events ever broken by intervention? Do you understand what I'm saying?
No, I do.
It just offends me with how he is being portrayed, and that, therefore, by extension, all people in wheelchairs suffer and have this horrible life.
Well, and let me just quote something from actually the Philadelphia Inquirer had an editorial about this, and it says they wrote City Hall didn't treat Barkley as well as it could have while he was still living. In the late 1980s, when Barkley sought specific loss benefits in addition to his disability retirement benefits, the city under Mayor Wilson Good fought his request in court. Commonwealth Court sided with Barkley in 1991, but trimmed his award to about one-fourth the original size. So clearly the family was trying to, or Barkley himself trying to get the medical benefits to which he felt he was deserved and needed, obviously, to live his life. But beyond that, I can't speak, but I thought it was interesting that the family had to fight City Hall, or Barkley had to fight City Hall, in order to get some of the benefits that he thought he deserved.
That's,
George, go
that's
ahead.
That's sad. I mean, that's just, I didn't know about that, but that's depressing. I mean, it sounds very much like he wasn't given the care that he should have been given, I think it's wonderful that your husband has been able to make such a great life for himself and overcome his disability. And I think that really just kind of accentuates what I've been saying and underlines it, that after 41 years, you have to go forward. You can't keep looking back and blaming someone from 41 years ago.
Every case is different, obviously.
Every case is different, and every case is fact-specific.
Right. So in this case, this was her husband's, or is her husband's life, and these were the results of this life.
Exactly.
But Barkley, perhaps on another trajectory.
Well, Barkley, unfortunately, if he was living, and we make an assumption, if he was living in a position where he was strapped for money and not able to obtain the kind of health care that is necessary for someone who is a paraplegic, you know, it could have set in motion a chain of events that we wish would have had a different outcome.
And we know how healthcare system works in this country.
Although this man was a police officer, he should have been taken care of properly. Mm-hmm. And if he wasn't, that's just adds to the tragedy.
Nancy, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me get Emily from Bucks County to join us. Hi, Emily. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty. Hi, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I sat on a jury in Bucks County about 4 years ago. I don't know if either of your guests are familiar with the case. And it involved a lot of medical testimony where there was a patient in a nursing home, an elderly gentleman with end-stage Alzheimer's. He had been abused very severely by one of the employees there. And she had subsequently been convicted of manslaughter. Now, the case that I was sitting on, which was related, was a hospice nurse had been charged with a type of negligence which made him culpable in the man's death. And there were two points to this particular case. He was either guilty of bodily injury and serious bodily injury, or just bodily injury alone.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that's difficult in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania is with this type of case, that we had a very long definition of the legal charge, and we're not allowed to take notes. So when we were in the jury, we had to come back about five times and have the judge read to us the definition, and it was very much splitting hairs. Because this man was in end-stage Alzheimer's and was a hospice patient, you know, we also wondered, you know, what are the responsibilities of the hospice nurse in this particular case when there were other people that were giving care to this man.
And Emily, let me just stop you there, only because we've got so many callers on the line. It's a very interesting case that you brought up, and I think adds to our conversation as we talk about how juries decide on complicated medical information, especially dueling medical information. Sadie LaDuff, go ahead.
Well, this is something that I am fairly familiar with over the last 20-some-odd years as a civil practitioner. In Philadelphia County now, at least on the civil side, jurors are able to take notes.
Oh.
They cannot take notes, however, during the judge's charge. Fortunately, murder is a fairly simply defined crime. The real issue is fitting the facts, fitting the medical the expert medical testimony into the definition. And I think that they're going to be able to do that. I don't really believe this is going to be complicated. Either the jury is going to accept that 41 years, that there has been an unbroken chain, or they're not going to accept it. I don't really see this as an intellectually difficult case.
How do you see it, George?
I think the jury, I find invariably juries get really confused by the jury charge, and I'm not surprised to hear the caller say that they needed to recharge five times because,
especially if you can't take notes, right?
You can't take notes on the jury charge, and these charges are incomprehensible. Lawyers often barely understand them, and there is some language that, Sadie, there is some language in the murder jury charges and the homicide jury charges, which is archaic. It's in the 19th century language, and nobody understands it. And even we lawyers who've done it for years, we know it more by instinct than by the words. So I think juries ultimately just go with their gut and do what they feel is right in a case. And I suspect that's what happened in the case that the caller did. They listened to all the evidence. They did what was right, and the jury charge was there. Yeah, we listened to it, but ultimately we did what we thought was correct.
And the question is whether a jury, if this case ends up in court, if a jury will end up in the same situation.
They will. They will. No question about it.
Emily, thanks for the call. We've got Leander from Tuscaloosa, Alabama joining us. Hi, Leander. Go ahead. Your Radio Times.
Thanks for calling. Thanks for allowing me on.
And thanks for calling. Go ahead.
The my main comment on the case is the case of George Corley Wallace.
Oh, sure.
As you remember, Governor Wallace was assassinated in the early 70s while running for president. And when he was assassinated, he was in a wheelchair the rest of his life. In fact, the man suffered the rest of his life from having been assassinated.
Well, attempted assassination.
I can't think of anyone in this state who would retry Arthur Bremmer when Governor Wallace did pass away, because when he passed away, it could be conjectured that the man died from the injuries from which he had suffered from that assassination attempt.
Right, right. And whether this, I mean, this, whether this is another example. Leander, let me see what Sadie LaDuv thinks about that.
This case, and the caller is absolutely right, but this particular case turns on the coroner's report, on the medical examiner's report, and George
even
made
though
a,
there's no autopsy.
That's right, and George, you took the words right out of my mouth. George made a great point about the fact that there is no autopsy. I think probably the prosecution is kicking themselves around the block. Now, in Governor Wallace's case, you know, again, I don't know, and I'd be curious to know if the caller knows whether there was a determination either by way of a coroner's report or by an autopsy indicating whether the governor's cause of death was, in fact, the attempted assassination. Then the next step occurs. That is, the assuming that it was, assuming that it was related, the prosecution then determines whether or not to prosecute.
And the question is whether anyone decided to do that. I don't think they did down in Alabama. And Leander, thanks for the call. Go ahead, George.
I was just going to say, what a great call-in, Leander, from Tuscaloosa. My father went to University of Alabama, by the way, and he was from the Bronx, where Sadie's from. So we have a lot
all
of connections
here.
Yes, but I agree with you totally. I think the people of Alabama would not have tolerated the prosecution of Arthur Bremmer for the shooting of George Wallace. And as I recall, George Wallace forgave Arthur Bremmer.
I think that's true.
He felt as a deeply religious man, he felt that that was something that was in his power to do. And I think nobody would have put up with a prosecution. We in Philadelphia will put up with a prosecution. Because the DA has that power and will do what she wants to do regardless. Public opinion is not the issue.
Leander, thanks for the call. We've got Joe from Fort Washington joining us. Hi, Joe. Go ahead. Your Radio Times.
Yeah, actually quite related to the last two calls. I'm a physician. I'm not a pathologist. Mm-hmm. But it seems to me that, especially learning now from what I'm listening to, there wasn't even an autopsy. I'm not sure why this became legal immediately. From a physician standpoint, I think the first thing that I would have questioned and subjected to very intense scrutiny professionally was the pathologic finding or the finding of the coroner that this is a direct relationship. Mm-hmm. I would have expected as a doctor that somebody would have looked at that very intensely with many other opinions before the charges were even brought.
And according to what I read, and I'm only repeating what I've read about this case, is that the cause of death was heart attack, but the coroner seemed to think that the heart attack was connected to infection related to the paralysis.
The pathologist that I read in the newspapers who did the analysis, whatever you want to call it, because there was no autopsy, was Ian Hood, who's the acting medical pathologist for Philadelphia, the acting coroner for Philadelphia. He's employed by Philly. He works, you know, the vast majority of his work is for the DA's office. I would not expect a contrary conclusion from Ian Hood. I mean, Ian Hood is not going to say this is not directly caused. I mean, he likes his job.
And I'm looking at the clock here, just a couple minutes before we have to say goodbye, but let's say he does get convicted, Sadie, and serves time. I mean, in a case like this, and we're talking about someone in their 60s?
Early 60s.
71, something like that, right, where the victim was actually in his 60s. Someone like that go to a geriatric prison or to a geriatric wing in a prison? What happens to someone?
It will not be a positive experience
wherever he goes.
He'll probably go to we do have a geriatric prison out in western Pennsylvania in the Laurel Highlands. And we will, if he were to be sent to prison, the Pennsylvania taxpayers will have the pleasure of spending
what does it cost?
$30,000 to $50,000 a year to keep him in jail when he's basically a harmless old man who walks with a cane. And I mean, to me, this is bordering on insanity in terms of seeking to prosecute him and incarcerate him.
Unless we take a full circle to where we were at the beginning of the show, and he is convicted of second degree, which would be third degree.
Because of the time passage,
and he's maxed out and doesn't do a day in jail.
And that would be the end of that.
Exactly, which is why, notwithstanding my orientation as a prosecutor, my prediction is a plea bargain.
Yeah. Well, on that note, we're going to end our discussion. I thank you both for joining us today on Radio Times. Thank you, Sadie LaDuff.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And George Duman, thank you as well.
It's been my real pleasure.
Good. I'm glad. Interesting show. Sadie LaDuff, a partner in the law firm of Abrahams, Lowenstein & Bushman here in Philadelphia, also vice chancellor of the Philadelphia Bar Association. And George Newman is a criminal defense attorney in private practice in Philadelphia as well. We appreciate all your phone calls to Radio Times. And for more information about the program, go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out about podcasts and leave us an email as well. Devorah Lissick, Alan Tu, Susan Greenbaum produced the program. Scotty Williams, the engineer for today's edition of the show. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thank you so much for joining us, and you're listening to WHYY FM Philadelphia, your member-supported news and information station serving Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware.